Hello everybody and welcome to Europa United's Eastern Dialogue, which is a series of podcasts focusing on the many aspects and insights of Eastern European states located at the crossroads of Western Asia and the European Union. My name is Ken Sweeney and I'm joined by my co-host, Paris-based journalist Vikram Murajan, who is originally from Yerevan in Armenia. In this episode, we will be reviewing the recent EAP Beyond 2020 Eastern Partnership meeting, which took place via video conference this month. And with us to discuss this is Deputy Director General of the European Commission, DG NEAR, Katerina Madanova. Katerina, thank you for joining us. Despite the dark cloud of the COVID-19 pandemic hanging over every summit and conference taking place this year, there still managed to be a summit for the Eastern Partnership, although it took place via video conference, of course. Now, prior to the conference, the term reinforcing resilience, an Eastern Partnership that delivers for all, was the buzz phrase going in. But in conclusion, do you believe that the goals of that term was reinforced? And what does it really mean, I suppose, if you can answer that as well?
Well, thank you, first of all, for inviting me to the podcast. It's great to be able to talk about a topic I very much hold dear to my heart, the Eastern Partnership. What it means to reinforce resilience? Well, first of all, it is a concept that is going to be the main framework for our work going forward. And I think it's very relevant concept, not only for the Eastern Partnership, but for the whole planet and the whole humanity, because really looking at the challenges we are facing, COVID is just the latest one of them. But when you look at the natural catastrophes, when you look at the rise of populism and populist leaders, when you look around the unraveling of the global rules-based order, I think resilience is the word that comes to mind that can help us through it. Because it's a concept that addresses almost any area of activity. It's a concept that is relevant for security, for economic resilience, societal resilience, institutional resilience, environmental resilience. So it was in all these aspects that we very much grabbed the concept to try to put a solid framework for the future of Eastern Partnership. And when we were actually doing that, we did not plan on the fact that the health resilience is going to be the first test of this concept, that mm-hmm. very much the whole way of surviving through COVID is about resilience. And so this was very much, it wasn't a full-fledged summit. It was what we call now a leaders video conference that took place on the 18th. And very much the notion of resilience as an overarching meta framework was welcomed and endorsed. And we are going to now work very busily on concrete deliverables, because we will have a physical, hopefully, summit in March of next year that will be under the Portuguese presidency.
Well, talking about deliverables, we had 20 of them for 2020. So we would just like to know, where are we with the plan, and have we learned any lessons from this strategy that has been before? And are there certain points that have been more or less accomplished, or the others that have been not successful yet and will be continued to be worked on?
I thought you were asking me whether we will have 30 deliverables for 2030, which certainly was a joke that we sort of found. I don't think we have the branding for the next deliverables yet, but what I can say is that I think the 20 deliverables for 2020 was a very useful, pragmatic framework through which we worked. Some areas more successfully than others. I think we have moved quite a bit in the thinking through of the connectivity of the region by endorsing the expansion of the trans-European networks and coming up with an investment planning for our engagement with international financial institutions to over time help build this expansion of the trans-European networks to the east, whether transport or energy or digital. I think mm-hmm. we've been very successful in fact turning about even over 60% of our financing for the SME sector into local currency financing, because this is a region with very high volatility of their currencies, and there is quite a reticence in incurring further liabilities by companies in hard currency. So this is something we really pushed hard our partners in the IFI to move in that direction. I think we have made quite some progress on the civil society in changing the way we moved from financing to supporting civil society organizations to do a lot more re-granting to reach a broader group of civil society actors and also do institutional grants. We were, I think, fairly successful in communication and undoing the really corrosive impact of Russian disinformation, which is so widely spread in the region by really putting emphasis on strategic communication. So there is a number of areas where I think we've had successes, but not completely across, you know. I think that the really embedding the notion of the rule of law in the day-to-day life and also institutionally supporting it through impartial and competent judiciaries and enforcement processes is still a challenge. There is, depending on which country, some country more, some country less, corruption continues to be an issue. And of course, we are talking also about region where, except for one country, there is either a frozen conflict or an outright hot war, like in Ukraine. So this is, it's not a completely easy region and an easy situation. And that's why I think that having these pragmatic frameworks that work on concrete areas is useful, and we will continue that in the future.
And there was a very important document, the Eastern Partnership Beyond 2020, that has been communicated in March while the whole world was busy with the coronavirus crisis. What do you think has changed in this document compared to the previous ones? Are there any particular differences? Why this document is new, and what is going to change for the Eastern Partnership countries?
So first, I think the method was different. It was adopted on the 18th of March in the first ever virtual meeting of the College of Commissioners. So I think that the method of its adoption was remarkable in its own right. But as you suggest in your question, it was sort of submerged in the immediacy of the COVID-19 pandemic, so we didn't get as much airing at it as it would have perhaps otherwise. I think what's important about the communication is that it recognizes Eastern Partnership as a key strategic dimension of the EU foreign policy, and it recognizes the Eastern Partnership region as strategically important. And I think it's and this is something that was echoed very strongly in the leaders' video conference on the 18th of June, where there was a recognition from parts of Europe that may not be the traditional supporters of Eastern Partnership, the recognition of the interdependence we have. We are a small continent, and well, you know, when you look at the pandemic and many other aspects, they don't stop at the Schengen border or the EU border. And and so I think this interdependence gave, or feeling of interdependence gave, even more impetus into seeing Eastern Partnership as an important dimension and important set of relationships that are important for Europe. So that's the main one. The second one is this resilience narrative, sort of meta-narrative I mentioned. And the third one is the areas we worked on previously are equally important now. So we are talking about economy, connectivity, people-to-people contacts, governance. But what is particularly notably in the communication that it aligns two new areas into the Eastern Partnership, which are key policies also for Europe, for inside the EU, and that's the green transformation and the digital transformation. So the bringing much more strongly and prominently to the forefront the decarbonization and to become a carbon neutral continent. Again, we cannot stop at the borders. So the European Green Deal made relevant for the Eastern Partners and the digital transformation on which we made such a leapfrog over the past few months, all of us collectively, is also brought out much more prominently for the future.
Can we say that those 20 deliverables have been rebranded into 5 policy objectives, and with the addition, of course, with 2 new points, which is the digital and climate transformation? Or there has been also a way of change of thinking in this new policy objectives compared to the previous deliverables?
No, the deliverables, I mean, they were 20 because we brought it down to concrete initiatives and projects, but they were clustered around 4 areas. And instead of the 4 areas, we are now have 5 areas because we put connectivity and economy into one, and we have the new one of green and digital. And we also continue with inclusive society. So that's the people-to-people aspect and the fundamentals of rule of law, accountable institutions, and security. So the areas grew from 4 to 5, but the ones we have been working on remain relevant. We just brought the additional ones of into bigger focus, which is digital and green. And what we are now going to be doing between now and the summit of next March will be to come up with concrete deliverables that we want to work around, because I find it in sort of the bureaucratic world and politicians' world as well, it is useful to have concrete initiatives and concrete projects that you work on, because that you can first of all achieve something, and second of all track the progress.
And do all the member countries have this enthusiasm and willingness to work on this new PAC policy objectives, or there is still a different level of interest and enthusiasm as it has been before?
You mean among member states of the EU or about
Eastern Partnership states? About,
well, look, I think that what is very clear is that all 6 Eastern Partners have very strong interest on working with the EU closer and working towards a stronger partnership with the EU. That is very clear. Now, beyond that, obviously the level of ambition is different. There are some countries that declare the level of ambition of eventually entering the EU, however remote that option may seem now, and others who would never want to work towards that objective. But that doesn't mean that as a cluster of countries, as the Eastern Partnership, would not want to. They all want to work towards a closer partnership.
Katharina, I'd like to talk to you about the fact that the EU responded quite swiftly to the COVID-19 pandemic. They provided, you know, pretty good logistic and material support to the EAP members. Long term, though, what are the objectives for improving health systems in the EAP states?
Well, I'm probably going to give you a slightly different answer than I would have given you half a year ago.
Yes, of course.
Where I would say that in the countries where this seems to be a big priority, like it was in Ukraine, for example, health sector reform, we became extremely strongly involved and deeply involved in the full reform of the health sector, with policy advice, with launching a reform support team in the Ministry of Health, by giving technical assistance resources, as well as by pushing for health sector reform outcomes in various projects as conditionality. So that was a very deep involvement in the form of the sector, but that was just because the Ukrainians asked us for support and they were so committed. We did not really have, this wasn't an area where we would have been involved by definition. Now, I think COVID changed that quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And And there is very much a recognition now that to deliver on our all overall resilience, the health sectors need to come in very prominently. So in addition to what you mentioned, Ken, of the support through PPEs and PPE, protective equipment, etc., what we are now rolling out is sort of a engagement in the policy of reform in sort of the areas of improving the performance of the health system, in rationalization of or reform of the hospital networks, in peer-to-peer exchanges, and in policy advice on reform of the health systems.
Would you say that the systems themselves at the moment are pretty good, or do they need a lot of improvement?
I think that there is sort of a still basic level of systems from the old times that still proved fairly resilient. I wouldn't. It's you know, compared to what? I mean, if I'm going to compare it to the performing system in Europe, weak. If I'm going to compare it to many other parts of the world, fairly solid.
Right. But they did deal with the COVID-19 pandemic pretty well. I mean, I think worst was expected and good came better. You know, I don't think that it was as bad as people envisioned it being.
I think so. I think that, but that was also a combination of reacting very quickly. For example, Georgia reacted extremely quickly by pretty much a full lockdown, which is costing them dearly economically, but in terms of you know, they only have a handful of death cases, and Georgia in fact was put on Tuesday on the list of countries that can enter the European Union in the summer as a result of that. In the other countries, the situation was not bad in comparison. Mm. Right now, a little bit on an upswing. The numbers are higher than they were 2 months ago, but they're still not catastrophic. They're not among the worst mm-hmm. faring cases. Belarus is a little bit of an outlier, but there was an interesting phenomenon. While the president himself was hesitant to declare any strict measures, the population actually did it by themselves. There was much mm-hmm. distancing, wearing of masks, etc., in a self-imposed kind of manner.
I see.
In the current COVID-19 context, I think the one thing that interests a lot of Eastern Partnership citizens is, do we have any kind of provisional timeline of when the borders with other five countries will be open?
I don't think that anybody has provisional timelines now, because it's going to be a function of the developments. I mean, it's I think that it would I certainly, you know, feel that it would be like gazing into a crystal ball to say what's going to be here in September or October. I mean, I think the experts don't agree yet, so. No, I don't think there is a provisional timeline. It's going to be reevaluated based on the situation,
which is the case across Europe and major yeah. parts of the world as well. It's just we're dealing with a completely new set of circumstances. Just like to touch on the Green Deal, the EAP members and their role. I mean, it's weird when you think about it, because you know Armenia has the Metsamor plant, Belarus is bringing the Astrovets online, which have been criticised by certain circles. So I'm just wondering, do you see a strategic role for the members within the European Green Deal?
Well, I see, in the sense that we are in it together. Mm. We are one, as I mentioned, we are a one small continent. So if the European Union is to make good on its green ambitions, then it needs to work very closely with its neighbors that they go through the transition in parallel.
Yes.
We are not starting from scratch. We have, over the last few years, invested very, very, very heavily, for example, in energy efficiency. I led a number of missions to the Eastern Partnership countries where we joined forces with the international financial institutions and, you know, IMF, World Bank, EBRD, EIB, IFC, to really push the envelope and incentivize the countries towards energy efficiency, especially in the building sector, and then invested in it. In, for example, in Ukraine, we invested 100 million euros into an energy efficiency fund for buildings mm-hmm. that now rolling out this support. And it's not only, it's one of these classical no regret public policy, because by investing in energy efficiency in buildings, you are supporting the local economy, new businesses, new companies, whole new professions like energy auditors. You are doing something good for the climate. And in the case of the Eastern Partnership, which is the most energy using part of the world, energy intensive part of the world, you are in fact supporting energy independence, because the cheapest energy there is the one you don't use. So we are not starting from scratch on the Green Deal. There are big elements that we have been supporting. We worked on biodiversity, we worked on forestry and forest rehabilitation issues, etc. But obviously a lot more work would need to be done on getting out of the overdependence on fossil fuels and overall bringing the energy intensity down and greening procurement, greening public services, etc. So there is lots of work to be done. And I think it's both in the interest of the countries as well as in the interest of the European Union.
Mm-hmm. Especially, I think, and this is the region, the Eastern Partnership, where the energy has a direct implications on the geopolitics and how
very much
are influencing the sector. So as soon as the countries will have an alternative sources of energy, a clean ones, it will also help them geopolitically, say.
Absolutely. Just to quote one piece of amazing statistics is that if Ukraine had the energy efficiency levels at the level of the lowest performer in the EU, not the average, the lowest performer, it would not need to import a drop of gas. Think about it.
Wow.
Right? Yeah. So it's becomes very much a security issue, energy security and a broader security and resilience issue.
With regards to the Green Deal, do you think there might be an urban-rural divide in terms of who's going to accept it?
Interesting question, urban-rural. I think that there, in general, there is probably an educational divide
mm-hmm.
and also sort of awareness raising, maybe generational divide as well. So I'm sure rural, urban as well. But I mean, I'm mentioning generational because you know, my 14-year-old sort of gets upset when I, you know, don't switch off the water faucet when I'm brushing my teeth.
The other question I just wanted to ask you lastly on that Green Deal is that, do you think that some lessons then could be learned from how the COVID-19 pandemic was, for the want of a better word, advertised to the public? Do you think that some positive lessons could be learned in terms of educating people with regards to a green conversion?
Well, I think so. I think that well, we certainly have learned, we as the European Union, we certainly have learned that we acted, you mentioned at the beginning that we acted very swiftly, but what happened in the first 3 weeks of COVID, when it sort of, in March, there was a tremendous amount of very well-executed and well-funded and very active disinformation in the Eastern Partnership countries about the EU and how the EU is falling apart and how we are at each other's throat and we have no solidarity within, and we of course are not going to let our friends in Eastern Partnership, you know, fall on their knees. That was the narrative, very active. And so part of the mobilization was driven by solidarity, and part of was also like, wait a second, we really need to counteract this really corrosive narrative. And so in addition to what we usually do, concentrate on the projects that would bring support, you know, the medical equipment and you know, credit lines for businesses, etc., we spent also energy on communicating about it effectively, more effectively. Something the European Union, as you only know very well, is not the best in communicating about its virtues.
Hence my question, often. Yeah.
And this time we really did it very purposely. And I'm very happy to say that when the day before the leaders' video conference on the 18th of June there was a new opinion poll released. And in every single of the six countries, the European Union is seen as the first institution that brought support to them.
Be trusted. Yeah, 60%, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah. So through, whether it's Ukraine, whether it's Belarus, whether it's Azerbaijan, whether it's Armenia, whether it's Moldova or Georgia. So that actually was very heartwarming, because it showed that if you concentrate your efforts on it, it pays off. And I think this was important, and this was very much the appreciation was very much felt also in the leaders' video conference.
As a citizen myself, a young citizen of Armenia, I can tell that I see in my own family, in my own community, how this 60% were achieved. Because 10 years ago, the European Union didn't have the same kind of connotations in the minds of the Eastern Partnership citizens, and it does now. A lot of amazing job has been done on communication, but still needs to be done, because there is a generational gap. And that is the most challenging thing, I would say, in preserving the messages that the European Union conveys daily to the Eastern Partnership countries. So just wanted to, talking about youth, today there has been a very interesting event, Eastern Partnership Youth Engagement Summit, and the Commissioner Oliver Varhelyi announced the launch of a new deal for youth. Has this deal been planned before the corona crisis, or is it kind of response to the corona crisis? What it's all about, and what objectives have been set for the specific youth deal?
Yes, it was indeed a very nice event. I had a chance to open it after the video message from the commissioner. So it was really great pleasure. I don't think the new deal for youth is a result of the corona crisis. It's part of the planning of the Eastern Partnership policy for the future, right? So we already had a very strong youth pillar in the among the 20 deliverables for 2020. We had a number of, you know, we had huge number of Erasmus Plus participants. We had an EU Fourth program. We worked on skills. We worked on civic engagement. But I think what we want to do with the New Deal for Youth is to concentrate particularly on, and what was discussed today were the two themes that we think are extremely important. One is the employment and employability, so the whole area of skills, labor market participation, and economic future of the youth. That's one. And the other one is policy and political participation, and to ensure that youth leaders, youth organizations have a stronger role or stronger voice, rather, in the shaping of policies that will affect them. I think we all remember the story of the Brexit demographic tables, right? That suddenly are outvoted, and people who are at the end of their lives are making choices that are going to affect you for a lot longer as a young person than themselves. And so I think with this sentiment that we want to see how to overcome the traditional, and not only in Eastern Partnership, globally, sort of hesitation of of the young people to politically participate and make their, you know, there is always a group that does, but a much bigger group of
that does not.
Don't. And so the one of the big focuses of the New Deal is to really find ways and develop initiatives that could facilitate greater policy and political participation and not participation but the voice of the youth in mm-hmm. shaping policies.
And the last question I would like to ask is about the fact that when we talk about Eastern Partnership and EU connection, we always talk about the level of integration of each country to the EU. Is there now a solidarity between, like, among the Eastern Partnership countries themselves? Because I have my some feeling that countries feel more divided than ever before, because previously we all have been post-Soviet countries with the same fate, the same kind of economic status, and right now there is a huge divide between all our countries. Can we say that the Eastern Partnership initiative has created more solidarity among those countries, or that actually taking away the solidarity that we had before?
I think that Eastern Partnership has contributed to civility and interconnections. I wouldn't say that this has been the biggest success, but not because this was never sort of the main objective. And I would personally, I grew up under a communist regime. I would personally not overstate the importance of solidarity in the communist regime. I mean, I'm not sure that the Soviet space, there was a lot of solidarity among the constituent parts of the Soviet Union. I mean, it was, a brutal regime that didn't let some of the nationalistic flares, etc., flare up, but emotions flare up. But I'm not buying the premise of the question that there was solidarity among the parts of the former in the immediate post-Soviet situation. But unlike the Western Balkans, for example, which is a contiguous area of six countries, here, you know, you have two bits of the Eastern Partnership. They are not even physically neighboring each other, right? You have the cluster mm-hmm. of Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, and then the Caucasus. So mm-hmm. Anytime I discuss this with colleagues, I always temper to the idea, or try to temper the idea, that we are talking about one region. We are not. So mm-hmm. I personally don't see this as even our important objective. That's not. I think it's to bring higher degree of solidarity. I mean, look, you have the Caucasus situation. I don't need to go into the details, which is complicated. And mm-hmm. plus, we have the ever-present Russia that keeps stoking the various conflicts in the region. So,
and will continue until 2036, at least.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's really regional stability, resilience, and prosperity are the main objectives.
Katerina, just one brief question I'd like to ask you on. It's in relation to just what Vico was just talking about. I mean, we had recently images of demonstrators and journalists in Belarus being detained and arrested due to the fact that they were protesting President Alexander Yushchenko's re-election campaign. I know it's a big question, so I'll appreciate it if you have to be brief for it. Is it becoming more difficult to allow the Belarusian administration to operate within the values of the EAP partnership and also in the future values of the European Union?
Well, look, I personally worked very closely with Belarus and different parts of Belarus. We continue supporting very strongly mm-hmm. the civil society in Belarus and the budding think tank community, etc. And we also work with the administration that in the framework of Eastern Partnership has actually been very constructive. Traditionally, over the last several years, I mean, you know of the role they played when the annexation Crimea and war in Donbas came about. You know, we have the Minsk agreements. They're called because they were agreed in Minsk, and so they play a constructive role now regionally. Now, in terms of domestic political repression, and that's a word I must use in this context because that's what's happening currently, is something that is of big concern to us. We'll see how the elections will take place. Mm-hmm. And there may be time when the president will have to make a choice.
Okay. It's a long road, I suppose.
Yeah. But look, all of these transformations and transitions, especially from a situation of a post-Soviet heritage, it's a generational thing. It takes time. And what I always like to tell my colleagues, that none of the reforms in none of the countries are linear.
Yeah.
And they're always, you know, two steps forward, one step back. And what we can do on the margins is to try to make sure there's two steps forward, one step back, rather than the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Katharina, thanks very much for taking the time to speak to us today. I think we'll all agree that the issue of the EAP is only a new, it's growing, and the difference in 10 years' time could be much more positive. I want to say thanks to my colleague, Vika. She put together two questions today. Really, really brilliant questions. Thank you, Vika.
Thank you, Vika.
It was really nice to be able to talk about so many different questions, but in the same context and in this format. So it's been my pleasure.
Guys, you've been listening to episode 5 of Europe United's Eastern Dialogue. My name is Ken Sweeney and my co-host is Vika Murujan. Our guest today was Deputy Director General of the European Commission, DG NIR, Katharina Matanova. In the meantime, you can check out all of our podcasts on our website, which is europeunited.eu. And we are also on Twitter and Facebook. And the same thing there, that's facebook.com, europeunited.eu, and twitter.com, europeunited.eu. Thank you very much to my guests, and we will see you real soon. Take care. Bye-bye.